So here we are, intending to finish topic three, even though it's the fifth class, for those of you keeping track of things. So this recording's going to be, for those of you listening, put together with last week's recording, as if it's just one long, what would come to be about a, you know, a 7-hour lecture, something like that. But of course we were finishing McGilchrist last week. To which I feel, just as a little bit of background, I should be aware that with this book, Taking Appearance Seriously, I've sucked a chapter out and it's standing on its own, but really it is intimately connected with the rest of the book. And if you want to take things a little bit further, I suggest you read the whole book. Because the book really is an arc of understanding that that's needed to. I'm trying to fill the background in as we go, but there's a lot of background to what he's saying. And one of the things that he doesn't mention specifically, but is in here, is it's what he's saying here is connected to what McGilchrist is saying, and he's aware of McGilchrist. He's aware of what he calls the bimodal brain. So they're part of a. It's intellectually, they're part of something that's grown up at I mentioned before, at Schumacher College. So McGilchrist and Bortoff both, well, Bortoff's died now, but they both taught at Schumacher, and it's part of a kind of a synthesis of ideas. In the development of what's come to be known as holistic science. So there's a bigger picture here of this more modern attempt to... I mean, I'd say it's significant enough that it would be... If it were to take root, it would be like the scientific revolution of the 17th century, if it were to take root in our culture. It's not as if there isn't another science available to us. By another science, I mean a whole other frame of understanding which puts what we already know in a different context. Because in a way, you can't look at science, the science of our culture, and say it's just wrong. Because, of course, we just know so much more about the structure of the material world, and that's not false. It's not being made up. It's a strange. You almost have to study philosophy to understand how things work. How science has a worldview in it. All science has a certain picture or understanding of the world already in it. But the thing about science and scientists. Is like everyone else. You don't see that world picture because it's already in the background and you're seeing out of it. So if you know, if you could confront, say, Stephen Hawking about this, or a lot of, you know, the top scientists, that they consider that philosophy is over as a subject. Because physics has taken its place. You know, we don't need to look into how the world is through philosophy, because the subject which reveals how the world is physics, which is it's a sort of an expression, a deep expression, you know, an expression that the media, our media, just says, here's the great Stephen Hawking, one of our great minds. Listen to him. He must know the truth in a certain sense. That's sort of it's embedded in us somewhere, that these great intellects have some kind of deep insight into reality. But the thing that we as ordinary mere mortals, not mathematical physicists, it's quite easy to recognise if we care to look at it. That somebody like Stephen Hawking, who thinks that thought, let's put him in the past, that philosophy is obsolete in a way, has just failed to understand what philosophy is. In a way, our whole culture, and every culture really, fails to understand what philosophy is. True or deep, profound philosophy is always concerned with the background, with the worldview that is being projected. Each culture projects a certain kind of worldview. That's the way it is. That's the way the human psyche is. And it's of great interest to me and to Henry Boutoff to look into the form of the projection that is our culture. And unless you can get behind that, you're kind of caught in either an agreeing or a disagreeing, a sort of a binary opposition, or you think it's great. You know, it's the only way out of the situation that we're in at the moment is to come to a true understanding of the situation that we're in first, not an opposition to it, a deep understanding of the situation that we're in. And holistic science is an attempt to do that. This sort of group of people who are attempting to form a different, consciously form a different kind of projection of what reality is. And then once you do that, the science that you do is different, and all of the facts that science has discovered come to have a different meaning because they're put into a different context. So, a holistic context. And Henry Boutoff is quite a significant figure, or was, in giving a deeper understanding of what it means to think holistically. And he got an awful lot of it from Goethe, the German. He was a poet and a scientist and a statesman. In those days, people were just all over everything. He's probably most famous in Germany for writing Faust, which is he's like a German Shakespeare, really, in the literary domain. But he also inaugurated a different kind of science. And he took on Newton, and he thought Newton's attempt to understand things by analysis and pulling things apart and understanding things mathematically wouldn't work with nature. And there's a whole chapter here that we're missing, which would be useful if we had the time, where Henry goes into what Goethe had to say about what a plant is. That in a certain sense, there is only one plant, and all the plants on earth are expressions of this one plant, but not in the way that we ordinarily think of plant being a sort of an abstraction, an abstract idea that covers, you know, if we think scientifically, we get some criteria that all plants have in common, and we think, okay, so now we've got a concept of plant. Whereas for Goethe, he was actually attempting to enter into some kind of essential union with the idea of what a plant is, and seeing that it's a dynamic idea. It's not in this lecture something I'm going to be able to get across very easily, but to get a sense of it, he would study particular individual plants in extreme detail and just look into how the leaves of plants become the petals of the flowers, that the, if you like, that the, that the, that the leaf, within the leaf, is the flower. That the entire plant, and I don't want to call it an idea. It's not like there's a fixed idea of plant, but it's something like this that a plant. I mean, Bortov talks about all of the different varieties of, say, the peony or the rose. That behind that, there's a unity that isn't just an abstract unity. There's a unity that you can see by looking at a peony. It's almost like the peony contains all the possibilities of all the hybrids that could be developed out of it.
So how does all that diversity come from like one thing? Like apples are really diverse as well, and particularly roses. It's just you just don't know what's going to come up. It's amazing.
I mean, I think although he doesn't go into it, there's really somewhere at the back of it is the entire idea of life on Earth.
Is that like a hologram? Is it like a holographic, like the piece within the piece, there is the whole?
Yes, yes. A holographic image is a good analogy where, you know, with a hologram, where you look into a hologram, if you've got a holographic three-dimensional, you know, you have to reflect light off it to get it, image of something, and you break that holographic plate, you'll get two images. It's not you get a half an image. You'll get the whole is present in all of the parts. So there's an aspect of that. So, and I'm not, I'm, we don't really have time to go into this deeply. I want to give you a taste that it would be, if you're interested in this, it would be worthwhile. Well, you know, you have to, there's an electronic copy of this at Sussex Library. Because of me, actually. So I'm not sure if you can access it if you don't have it. If you're in the library, you might be able to, but not remotely.
I meant to ask, yes, John, if there's some way we can get some connection with Sussex Library, you know, with the University.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, that when you're doing a course elsewhere, you can get on to, is it Scunnel?
As far as FUB is concerned, I think there's an arrangement whereby you can use the library by going into it, but you can't borrow material and you can't have electronic access.
You can actually get in.
Yes, but I think there's.
You can't borrow.
Yeah, but
anyone can use the computer.
Yes, you can.
Where is the
library? Sussex University Library. It's the opposite. You know where the university is, Falmouth Station. It's once you're on campus, just say where's the library.
Okay.
Somebody will say it's over there.
Yeah.
Basically, if you're looking from the A27, it's sort of halfway down on the left hand edge of the campus. Quite a big building.
So there's also one big library on the Lewis Road. Is that the Brighton?
Yes. Yes. I mean, between you and me and not the tape, an awful lot of books are just sitting there as PDFs on the internet. But this isn't one of them. Most of Heidegger's work is you can get. I think McGilchrist, I was grabbing that. That's available at Sussex, but not necessarily online. There are bits of pieces of McGilchrist's book. You know.
Sussex have a deal.
Yeah, I got McGilchrist books. I read it last year on Google Play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some other books I read it online.
Yeah.
Some of his lectures.
An awful lot of the material we deal with is online somewhere. Whether it's, you know, I have to hesitate to say whether it's, you know, just been pirated, probably has, but. Henry Bortoff's book is quite rare. It's quite a, outside of that Schumacher College circle, it's not that well known. To which I say,
whereas in England, there's Schumacher College in England, right?
Yeah, in Devon, in Dartington Hall outside Totnes. So they hold a little flag, but it's quite a significant flag in the ecology world. So because there aren't many places that are quite so radical, something like that can't really survive in a modern university. This has managed to survive because it's privately funded, but it's still affiliated to the University of Wales, Bangor, I think. Accredit their courses, so you can do courses there, but they're very expensive, or quite expensive. They were very expensive, now they're quite expensive. I'm just mentioning that because it's quite in the background. A lot of what I'm saying, you'd say, well, where is this? Where is there something corresponding in the world? Where would I point you to say I'm not just sitting here on my own? You know, I'd say, well, Schumacher's in a worldly sense probably closest to what we're studying here. We're everyone's arriving. So the good morning. Good morning. At the end of the last class, it was quite amusing. I think the thinking in the class was the class ends when there's nobody left in the room but me, because Wes let me go on, and slowly people just started leaving and leaving. And I think it was Nicolette and a couple of others left at the end. But there was a little bit at the end there where I started to talk about a dynamic approach and about phenomenology. I feel I should just start to enter into it again. So with last week's lecture, we were looking at this question of what is meaning, and we were looking at whether meaning is a kind of object or a thing, whether when somebody writes a book, there's a certain sense that there's some sort of fixed meaning that they then place into what they write, and your task really is to grasp that meaning or reproduce that meaning, like you form a perfect copy of it. And there you have it. You have what the author meant. And I think we were at a certain point in there. I was saying, this is a sort of my understanding. I don't think Boltov says this. Is that's a kind of an ideal that is true. It's something that science and mathematics aim at. It's a and computer science there are mathematical proofs, computer programs, absolutely precise mathematical formulations in scientific papers that attempt to do this, to say there is one unambiguous fixed meaning and you either get it or you don't. So it's not as if such an idea of a meaning it doesn't exist. But that's like a pole, an extreme pole, and almost an extreme ideal, because there are people in philosophy of language, which in a way is what we're dealing with, especially in the middle part of the 20th century, who actually thought that it would be possible to take our human language in some sense translate it into a mathematical language which would make it absolutely unambiguous. And this isn't just an abstract task. This is, if a computer is ever going to, in certain sense, effectively communicate with a human being, then it's going to have to be one approach to doing that is to attempt to translate human speech into an absolutely precise mathematical language that the computer can then essentially calculate with and work out what its response is, and then translate it back from this computer language to human speech and start to communicate like that. And there's a Steven Pinker is an evolutionary biologist who even formalized this and called that language mentalese, because his thinking was that that's what the brain does. The brain actually has its own language, if you like, which is a language of pulses of neurons, which he calls mentalese, which then, in effect, controls our speech, and we get what we call natural language coming out. So I just think it's giving you the picture that there is a bunch of people who think that everything finally, the ground reality, is that everything just grounds out in the physical world. And if everything grounds out in the physical world, then so does language. And if language grounds out in the physical world, then it grounds out in the discrete actions of the firings of neurons in a human brain. And if that's all that there is to language, then there should be some kind of computational binary way of representing the true language, mentalese, of what's going on in the brain. Do you see the whole... I almost feel like... Do you see the whole madness of it?
Yes, yes, yes.
But not.
But then you are allowing for mistakes and different interpretations, isn't it?
So but your mistakes and your different interpretations finally ground out into mentalese, which is explicable entirely in terms of the cause and effect of events happening in your brain. Do you see that when you get down to that level, there isn't even any such a thing as meaning anymore, as we would understand it?
Mm.
It becomes meaningless. It becomes a computational event, which is just a chain of cause and effect events. The fact that we experience meanings as a result of this is the mystery.
Mm.
I think so que the people who should see more in this specific knowledge, in any specific knowledge, si es maths or si es philosophy or physics, the people involved in this improve and create.
Yes, and they are. The thing about this, of course, is that speech recognition is starting to become impressive, isn't it? And the kinds of responses that the computers are going to be giving back are going to become increasingly more impressive. This whole thing is not...
Que example in this moment is Sophia, the girl, the humanoid.
Yes.
Really fresh about this.
Yes, yeah. So all of this idea that all of human language can be nailed down into something, some specific, unambiguous, basic representation, is not just a philosophical idea anymore. There are millions, if not billions, of dollars being spent on this, because if we can simulate human language in a computer, do you see how many millions of people will be without a job? Dare we say billions? Do you see if a computer can manage the transactions of human conversation, it's all over for most of us, isn't it? In terms of our being needed. I'm sorry to go off on this. And on this other level, do you see the madness of it?
Mm-hmm.
That we're spending all this money to get rid of ourselves?
It's being needed by who then? So because only elite people will then be other people in control of everything.
But nobody's...
Why are we not needed? But
just let me answer that. The thing is that it's... again, I think we need to understand the nature of the system. It's the system itself that is... It's the form of the system that's driving the research and the money, because It's within the form of the essential competition that's going on. You see, if it's like the nuclear bomb. If we don't do it, they will. And they will. Do you see? It's not like you, like somebody would say, "Oh, I don't think we should do this." Well, fine. You don't survive. Do you know? We've set up a system where this essential, you know, we were talking about this essential aggression and competition that's part of our biological inheritance, if you like, is determining the top level behaviour of this.
Even if it wasn't for that, it would still be an interesting, curiosity thing to do, to try and develop.
Oh yes, yeah. And then there's loads of people like that. That's what I was doing.
Yeah.
That was my life. Yeah. And there's loads of people working in artificial intelligence who don't. I mean, I used to say to my PhD students, I don't mind what you do, so long as it never has any practical application whatsoever. You know, but I can say that now because I'm not being employed. Yes, because of course, whatever the people working at it, like all of the scientists, it's the delight of discovery. You know, you pose this problem, and it seems insoluble, and then you have a brilliant idea. And it's all about the brilliant idea, but of course the effect of any brilliant idea, especially in the domain of computing, is that there's a whole bunch of people waiting in the wings saying, "Well, there's money to be made, money to be made." Yes.
There's a counterbalance, though, really, to this. If we're seeing this as madness, if we know that it's madness, and a lot of the media. But what's in the media at the moment is this salient point was in the last election, talking about global climate change. So isn't that the actual diametric opposite of saying that one system, if we don't actually, you know, solve this problem, we're all going to the wall? Because what you're describing here is that effectively the system is taking us directly to the wall. So wouldn't that be the way for us to kind of think, hey, wait a minute, we've got to turn this logic on its head? Is that a possibility in terms of a consciousness thing, do you think? Or is that too general? To combat the whole of making sense.
Well, I think you know, Nicolette and I were walking up the street today feeling a bit gloomy about this.
Okay.
I mean, systems collapse very quickly. And I don't think we should underestimate. It's like we all sort of live in this system, and it feels like it's just going to go on and on and on, and nothing we can do to make any difference, because it seems to be impervious to any real reform.
Okay.
But that I don't think it's impervious to complete collapse.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
that's
Manhattan,
yes.
Isn't
yes.
It?
Yes.
It's just like, how is anything running there?
There was that eruption in Iceland that put all the particles in the air,
yeah.
that stopped the jet planes being able to fly, and that would only needed to go on for a bit longer, and the whole thing would have started to unravel. Do you know, because the global system is now so interconnected and so interdependent,
mm-hmm.
that it's got very little resilience.
Are we going to know that the system has collapsed? Because in some parts, really distant, like hamlets in Caucasus or Mongolia, people still think that the Soviet Union is there.
Yes. Oh well, no. That's where you want to live when the when the supermarket shelves start emptying. That's when you know, when things are going wrong, when the supermarket shelves are empty.
And it goes really quickly, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah, it's always there.
Oh no, I used to study this years ago. You know, just in time inventory. It was a great new idea from Japan. You know that you don't hold any inventory. You just get things delivered just in time, which means that basically the whole world now it's got about 3 days of of safety before it's all over. You know, whereas once upon a time it was different. I've done a big sweep here, and I was just really talking about holistic science being. Because in Scotland, in a way, that's what you were talking about. Because we need an entirely different frame of understanding on which our culture is based in order to change the system under which we're living. It's not a reform. I don't see that reform is possible. But I think a fundamental shift of consciousness would do the trick. And it's such fundamental shifts of consciousness have occurred in the past. Often it can be catastrophic, but sometimes there can be... things can change reasonably... you know, without the whole world being utterly destroyed, yes.
Yes, I think so. Okay, positive consequence of technology, in this case, the people are replaced in every world, is the human pass a feeling more tranquil and more peaceful, he pass a enjoy herself in new paradise. See, the technology advance in humanoid world. I think so.
Yes. One of the things that makes me a little... I guess, having said that, one of the things one should be looking for is signs of change of consciousness on Earth. That's why Nicola and I were, you know, we can feel a little bit gloomy walking up the street. It's not that there aren't... You know, it's like the bell curve again. There's certainly people who are ready to live in a different kind of world.
Do you have any examples of a shift in consciousness?
Well, I would say that the scientific revolution in the 17th century swept away that entire medieval world, which in its way was mad in a different way. You know, because that medieval world, we're out of touch with it now.
Consequently, the 90s, the 1970s, now the concept is the people keep thinking in these ideas.
But I'm thinking of way back in, you know, in the 1400s. Things started to change there, and it took you know hundreds of years. For the change to happen, but it did happen. That medieval world, with all of its inquisitions, and you know, there's plenty of bad things that were going on.
For me, the very real impression, Julio Verne.
Who's that?
The person who writing, the first person who writing about the travel, the here at the space, yes. He writing a writer, Julio Verne. I don't know if my pronunciation is correct.
Does anyone know? Who's it? No.
Jules Verne.
Yes.
I read online. I read impression about the old noise about this auto, because the person think many yes. About all the technology and all the advance. I don't know, but it's really quite
best for me. Yes. So I'm going to pull back from this prognosis for the human civilization, because. But I would stick with the idea that and it's a systems idea. I think that our particular system is in a kind of a, you know, I don't know if you know about visualizing the kind of space within which complex systems live, but they tend to live in a basin of normality, like the weather. Do you know? And as you get to the edge of the basin, things become more and more unstable. And it's like there's a ridge around the basin where you live, where you can go entirely out of that basin into a state of relative chaos, but that's a good thing because there are other basins of stability around that you can fall into. And so I regard, I guess, our world culture as a certain basin that we've been in for quite a long time now, and even got in even deeper, I think, as things are progressing since the Second World War. But there are other basins around, but I see them as being completely different to where we are now. It's not as if I don't see this particular basin of global capitalism being gently reformed. There are deep structural reasons why things are the way they are, and the main one being, I mean, I don't like to say it. I remember somewhere, I'm not sure where, it may have been the early 1980s, somewhere like that. I feel like something like the rich have won. The battle was lost somewhere decades ago. And global capitalism is the expression of global capital, and now it runs the show, and no national government can do anything about it. It's just not even the United States. The money and the money power has got beyond national boundaries. So it's out of the jurisdictional control of any government or any, democratic organisation of people.
Or king.
Yeah. What could Jeremy Corbyn really do against global capital?
But anyone can get rich.
Yeah. Well, when you say anyone could get rich,
that's again within the
company. Everyone can get rich.
But any, I guess if you were a medieval person, anyone could get rich then if you were prepared to be violent enough.
It was harder to become a noble.
Within the structure of the system, but you could just extreme violence was still, a very successful way of becoming rich. Always has been, hasn't it?
Well, no, people are rich, the spirit and love.
Basically, is they're all born.
Yes.
You win this, you survive it. Not the rest of your life.
But I keep wanting to say. It's no use fingering the rich. The rich are caught. They're caught within this system, where if you start losing interest in being rich, then you won't be rich for long. Someone else will take your seat. It's not personal anymore. The most ruthless will succeed. That's the structure of the world that we've made, and the only thing that can really ameliorate that it would be a world government. I mean, I accept that.
Also, it's not entirely true that the most ruthless is the one who succeeds. Because if you look at like Bill Gates, for example, he didn't succeed out of just ruthlessness, so, ruthlessness.
He's got a monopoly though, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I know, but the reason why he kind of monopolized is, you know, he did bring in something that he brought in first, you know, he brought it in first, and that became popular, you know.
What you're saying fits in with the picture. Do you see, if somebody gets there first, they have a little period where they don't have to be ruthless.
And so
that just demonstrates that people aren't essentially ruthless, because you'll find that people like Bill Gates, when the system allows it, will start to try and be benevolent. I mean, that's what he's tried to do subsequently. But he had to be ruthless in order to succeed in the first place. And then there's a little period, which is exactly as Scott says, where you have a monopoly, where the others haven't caught up. But as soon as they have caught up, it's back to.
It's collaboration, isn't it? It's about. I'm just saying it's very simple to just say, well, you know, yes, I can be ruthless or violent and achieve.
No, I don't mean by violence. I mean the structure of the system is such that it allows governments to set laws for the reasons for its own survival. Right. If there were no laws, then it would fall apart. So there has to be a sufficient structure to enable business to function. But within the structure, in the business world, it's the most effective, most cost-effective, most efficient business is going to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it has to sink to the lowest possible allowable behaviour.
So 0-hour contract.
Unless you have a monopoly for a little while, but if there's competition, that's just, you know, it's from Adam Smith. It's part of what capitalism is. You've set the playing field. Now off you go. Let's play, and the winner is the one who.
But if we say okay,
who's most effective?
So if we were all equal back in the days of monkeys or whatever, pretty much, you know.
I don't know if we were, but yeah, that was physical strength then, wasn't it?
But I mean, we were kind of, you know, in terms of, I mean, obviously money and riches has enabled, you know, unprecedented differences in human beings, yeah. So, I mean, even the strongest monkey hasn't got
the reach of a
human, you know. So I'm just saying, like, if we got from there, we were kind of all pretty equal, sharing, you know, having very basic resources. Can we become equal in and having kind of modern healthcare or whatever that we create? Because, you know, when you're sick, you will benefit from, you know, a new heart transplant or whatever, yeah? And to go to this new heart transplant, we go through all of this that came until now, all this modernity and competition and whatever. But now we say, okay, well, we want to keep the good fruits of all of this labor in competition. But we now want
hands going up here, so saying, well, you know, the National Health Service is the fruit of the collaboration of the unions and the creation of the Labour Party. So it hasn't all been about business, but I guess it. This is why I'm pointing to around about the 1980s. That was when that kind of balance of power, that it was still an imbalance of power, but there still was the ability of a Labour government, I'm thinking of England, to actually, in a way, negotiate with capital.
Yeah.
And the unions were able to negotiate with capital about wages. And there was actually It was experienced as a clash, right, an instability, but it was an expression that there actually was some kind of parity of power, and that parity's gone, and that's I think essentially explains the world we live in now. You know, you're pointing at 0-hour contracts and you think it's just horrible people. It's essentially that the balance of power has shifted so dramatically in favour of capital because of globalisation, and it was the intent of capital to promote that. And in the name of people didn't do it because they thought, oh yeah, we're just going to screw everyone. It was in the name also of if you like, spreading what people thought to be a marvellous system across the globe and raising all the other, you know, raising Southeast Asia, you know, China, you know, it was all considered to be great stuff. Although, you know, you turn China into another sweatshop, don't you? Yes. Yes, Nicolette's going to say, stop, John, and we're going back to the... Yes, some of us have done the reading, says Nicolette pointedly, she being one of them, but did it last week, so I've probably forgotten.
Here we all agreeing though that the best, the greatest success is financial success. Like if you're rich, say you're a millionaire, where are you going to put? If there's a lot of stresses coming, where are you going to put your money? What if a crash happens? What if? How? Which bank to trust? How to? It's a lot. So your mind is going to be completely occupied, not free. You're going to wake up in the morning, you have a lot of things to do on the schedule. So,
that's the case of your skin as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you've got a family and, you know...
No, I can talk to you about, how terrible it is to have enough money. You know, I suffer from that. The thing is, if you have enough money, really have enough money, there's no necessity to anything anymore in your life.
Yeah.
Every morning you wake up and you think, well, what am I doing here? Do you know, the thing about a certain degree of having a lack of money is you don't ask yourself what you're doing. You think, I've just got to get out. I've just got to make enough to pay the rent. Do you know, it gives you a certain... there are different ways of living. I know that everyone would choose to have enough money, including me.
Yeah.
I think there was something, though, that was said about happiness. You can have the necessity, you can have enough necessity, you've got the necessities of life. Whether you earn 20,000 seems to be the normative amount that you need to be relatively happy. And that's not a very good way of describing it in the UK. But even if you earn 80 grand, you're not necessarily going to be any happier because the basics are already covered by earning that amount. But in our society, they're always pushing you to take on more.
There's two votes now to say enough. Enough. I'm with the hands over here. Let's do a little bit of what we came to do, and just let me see if I can get this to wake up again. All right, so just spinning through what we did about the common sense view, about there being something like a fixed meaning that you have to get from an author and then reproduce in yourself. And then the idea that everybody ends up with a different idea of what the meaning of a text is. And how do you know who's got the correct one? How could you possibly know that you actually have the meaning that the author had? Especially if the author's dead. You know, so we've got this problem with this idea of meaning being fixed and being something that the author had in mind, even though that's what we consider to be the common sense view. And then there was a little slide about meaning and significance saying, well, there is a meaning, a fixed eternal meaning, but what we actually experience is the significance of that meaning to us. And then he's saying, well, the problem with that is that meaning then becomes something inaccessible. And I don't know if you remember, we were talking about, it's like Kantian philosophy, where it's like all we ever experience, it's a parallel to perception, where in philosophy there's the same problem with the representational theory of knowledge, which says that actually what we experience in perception is a kind of a private experience in our consciousness that represents the real external world. How can we ever be sure that what we are experiencing in our private stream of consciousness is actually how things are out there? It's the same, do you see, it's the same problem? How can you be sure that what you're experiencing as the meaning of the text is really the real true meaning? And he's trying to say, well, the problem here is if you think that way, there's no way out of it. If you think there is a fixed, real, true meaning out there, existing in the author, then you can never get around this. You can never be sure that you've grasped that real, true meaning. You're kind of stuck in a limbo of uncertainty. Really, in that world, the sort of picture is you're stuck in the bubble of your own consciousness and never really knowing if there's anything outside of that bubble that corresponds to what you're experiencing.
McGill Christ also said that understanding is provisional. We understand things in relation to other things.
But we're trying to get out of this view, and the way out, according to Bortoff, and I think according to phenomenology, is that we don't have to, but I think the only way out is to come back to your immediate experience and say, this immediate experience that I'm having now is the only reality that there is, and to think of it as a bubble of consciousness well, the best way I can put it, well, that's just the thought, right? To think that thought, okay, you can think that thought, but if you just come back, the only reality that we have is, even to say that it's consciousness is a mistake. I'd like to sort of just pull us, everyone, back to there's something going on here. I'm experiencing being here in this room with all of you before me. I don't experience any consciousness or any external world, or any kind of division into subject and object. I don't have any direct experience of there being a meaning in someone's mind. All of these are, if we pull back from our reflective understanding, you just come back to the immediacy of what's happening. And phenomenology is always about that. Phenomenology is about, so let's just look at the immediacy of what's happening, of my experience, and the time on the clock in that world is always now. It's just always now. And the amazing thing is, wherever you are, that's always what the time is. You know, where. If you come back to some kind of immediate presence, it's always now.
Always here.
And it's always here. It's a kind of a terribly simplistic statement that if you just say it to a mind, the mind will just say, yeah, yeah, I know that. But actually, if you just come back, there's a tremendous... This is one's life. This is where everything happens, where everything that matters to you is. This is where you love. This is where you feel pain. But we have this other world, and it isn't. It is almost another world, which you'd say is a world of thought, where we can project ourselves into the past and the future, and into our imaginations and into our ideas of things. For example, our idea of the world economy and global capitalism. See, none of them are actually here. Do you know? We have this enormous picture of how the world is, but again, phenomenology is always a matter of saying, "Well, psh, 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 psh. But actually, what we actually have is our being together in this room. And I'm pertaining to what Henri Bortov is saying. We are in the about language. I put it to you that everything we need to know about language is happening now as you listen to me speak.
I understand.
Yeah. So here we are, in the presence of meaning and understanding. I mean, the best I can do with this, and I like to do this in classes because it helps me, is I get to a point where I start to just experience the words emerging out of my mouth. Do you know, they're just coming out. I'm listening to them just like you are. And there's no little man in me thinking, I'm just going to say this. No, there's no little man. I just am saying this. And as I'm saying it, the meaning of what I'm saying is immediately present with what I'm saying, as it is for you. And there's a certain level here where we're all listening to this. It just happens to be coming out of me. So it feels differently to me. And but you have to be somehow in the place of this. Because you can be in another place where I'm saying this and you might be thinking about it. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be, but if you're thinking about it, you've already left the immediacy of the pure meaning of what I'm saying. But sometimes, if somebody's producing a stream of meaning and there's something questionable in it,
really superficial language production, really superficial language. In my case, I recognize what people speak superficial language in what people is important. For example, for me it's important listen you.
Yes.
Because I recognize que no es superficial language.
Yes.
I value this.
Yes.
Yes, but unfortunately
a lot of it is superficial.
No, all day.
Yes.
All day.
No, it's
good. Capacity to listen this.
Exactly.
Speak.
You have to in a way there's a place for stepping back from the meaning of what's pouring out of the media, for instance. Or someone who's doorstepped you and trying to sell you something. Do you know that it's you can't just, you have to be careful really about the meanings that you open yourself up to. But here we're just interested in meaning itself.
Yeah, so that's secondary, isn't it? With the doorstep competition, the meaning you project into that is secondary, isn't it? Because it is what the immediacy of, and it talks about understanding and meaning being a unitary.
Yes.
Experience.
Yes.
They're both the same.
Yes. And that's the thing. Do you see? It's an amazing moment that there is just nothing going on. There's no gap between my words and the understanding of the words. Do you know? There's not like a little half a second, unless you might have trouble with English. If you've got trouble with English, there might be a half a second, or you might be translating this into another language. But if you're with... If
you,
yeah, yeah.
People don't understand all you say, but all you say, I understand not.
So it's quite. Nicolette was talking about this in relation to reading books. There's something quite miraculous, isn't there, in the way that these sounds are meanings. I mean, this is we're getting the dynamic approach. You see, if you get back to this the fact that meaning is only ever present now, then you've got rid of this subject object, the meaning in the author's mind. How can I know that I've got the true meaning? Well, you've already placed the meaning somewhere else, right? The in actual fact, our entire experience of life is a pure stream of meaning, and it's not just language. Whatever you look at, at a certain level, and if we get to Bortov's next chapter, he's going to say this, you know what it is. You don't have to tell yourself, right? I don't have to say there's a window. You know, I don't have to say, there's somebody outside the room, I can hear some sounds. Do you know that everything that I'm sensing is also it means something. There isn't, I don't sense a bunch of sensations and then say, oh, what does that mean? No, it's a window. Do you know, wherever I look, I see meaning. I experience meaning. Just like that. Do you see that language is like a next level up? It's almost like with the senses, you experience meaning absolutely raw. That's raw, immediate meaning. And yet, it seems that language is involved in that too. This is one of the deeper aspects of language. That if we were without language, there's a certain sense that we wouldn't know that that's a table.
So, are we mixing the language with what concept is? Is the concept one thing and language another, or are we...
So, these are questions that, they're quite... You know how philosophy is. When you go into them, you start to realise that nobody really knows what language is, and nobody really knows what a concept is. And in a way, you have to go into each of these high-level words and see if you can find something in your experience that corresponds to them. And we don't live in that kind of world. We live in a world where people use the word concept and we think we know what it means. But we do we?
Yes, I remember the 10 years old in one biology class. One teacher said me, why... You say table at a table, a chair at a chair. Possible I say table at a chair at a table. Why? In one class many years ago, yes, true. Why not? Que es el dilema del linguistic. Why? Why you say this? Why? Why? For culture, for routine, for any other person, continuous repetition, this mean.
Well, we can go back into childhood, and you can see how you were trained to call that a table. But with your idea of I can tell you, I think it's pretty much accepted now, depending on what you mean by concept, that dogs have concepts. Yes, but they don't have language. So that there is a difference between having a concept and having language. And that's one of the kind of deep questions of this course, is what's the difference between, if you like, a dog knows what a cat is. In a way, having a concept is something like, behaviourally, being able to distinguish different classes of thing. A dog knows it's a lamppost. Yes, it's a dog knows it's you, and not somebody else. Do you know? So the dog has an ability to classify, and this ability to classify and put things in categories we associate with concepts, but it doesn't mean the same as language. And yet, obviously, language. But is it, without concepts, there'd be no language.
Yes, but the concepts.
Yeah. So obviously, language is growing out of
yes.
Out of this what we would say. But I'd prefer to put I'd prefer to call them almost perceptual categories. You know, that would be a better way to put it, because concepts sound like you're already at university. Yes, there's something kind of crucial here that I feel I need to jump into Boltoff's next chapter. He quotes a fascinating piece from Helen Keller. You know that she had measles when she was very young, before she learned to speak, and she was deaf and blind, and was going to be thrown on the scrap heap, really. But she had reasonably wealthy parents, and they employed a governess to look after her. And the governess persisted to try and teach her what language is by signing on her hand. And there's a beautiful passage, I think we might get to it, where she remembers the day it happened, that she realised that what her governess was signing on her hand, she was doing that, and then kept putting her hand into some flowing water, and then was signing water, and then putting her hand in water and signing water. And there was a moment where she suddenly realised what it all meant, and she the way she expressed it was, she suddenly getting that was language. And in the moment that language occurred, there was a world. Before that, she had no world. She'd made no, in quotes, sense of it. And it was then that, if you like, not only was the water there, but she knew it. Do you know, it's similar for us. We live in this, so it's very hard to catch it. Not only is there a table there, right, you're seeing it, you've got the visual impression, in the way that, if you like, we can't transpose ourselves exactly into how it would be for another mammal, but you can see that other animals see the table. But we know it's a table. And that knowing it's a table isn't just a little thing going, I know it's a table. Do you see, the thing about trying to explain something like this is we're trying to point to what language is. So there's nothing you can do in language that gets you out of language. You can only kind of sort of try and gesture.
Slightly off track here. I mean, when I read the text, there's this word understanding, and you know, it's taught me that it's made up of understanding. And do you think there's any kind of something behind it about this understanding, standing under, in the concept of understanding, that what we think of understanding is somehow being envisioned as standing under, or why is it, I don't know, I think.
Well, I think we're all on the same. We all have the same sense, don't we? Of what you have to start with what understanding is, which is happening now. I'm understanding you. You're understanding me.
Yeah.
So it's an actual experience. Language understanding is.
Yeah.
But there's the other understanding of understanding that it's a table. And I don't know that it's a metaphor, isn't it? Your understanding means that you've got you in some way it implies that there's something underneath what you're seeing that you're also seeing, which in a way is partly, if I'm going to go with this, you understand that it's a table, which means you know a whole lot more about it than what you're seeing. You know what it is.
Yeah. So it's kind of it's kind of being on the level of being above the physical thing.
Right? Let me go back into a kind of a Heideggerian view of an animal's, according to Heidegger, this is, so it's there's some speculation in it. An animal's experience of things like tables and chairs and you and me is how do these things impinge upon my instinctual nature? What are they for? You know, what are they for? What do they afford? The word that the technical word is affordances. That animals are aware of the affordances of things, which is that they're living in a what can I do? Do you see that this is for eating? This is for mating with. This is for chasing. It's all. The experience is all in relation to my responses to these things, but the animal doesn't see the thing. Do you see that?
My father is
like that. Your father's like, yeah. phenomenologically speaking, we allow the being of something else to stand before us. Just in itself, entirely independently of how we might interact with it. Even though that's there, we've got all of that animal, tables are for putting things on, chairs are for sitting on, that's all going on in the background, but we have this extraordinary consciousness that just enables us to allow something to show itself to us as it is from itself. Are you getting a sense of it?
Mm-hmm.
We don't always do that, but we can, and we can do that with each other. You're not just a thing that's evoking instinctual reactions in me. If I fall back far enough, I see you. Do you see this? I see you, and it's not a subject-object thing. It's an extraordinary capacity of human consciousness. I mean, there's a level here. I remember Carl Jung made something of this. This is what we're here for. None of the other animals really hears the robin sing. You know, none of the other animals really sees the feathers, the beauty of the feathers. That's what we're here for. We've got this capacity to allow things to present themselves to us. Are you getting a sense of it? Because what I want to inject in that is that language is part of that. That's what Helen Keller was saying. Things couldn't reveal themselves and stand before me as they are in themselves until I had language. Before that, I couldn't tell you what it was because I didn't have language. And it's not just a matter of, if we think language is an ability to explain or abstract or think, but there's a deeper level where, I mean, Heidegger makes a lot of this, where it's the house of being. Because if you see everything that we allow to be to stand in front of us has its own word. even though if you look in the feathers of the robin, behind the word the feathers of the robin are the feathers of the robin. Do you know, behind language there's the sensory meaning as well, which, you know, the language goes so far, and then all the details of the sensory meaning flow off from that into a place where language can't follow. And yet we need the language for the being of the things that are around us to be able to show themselves. I mean, in a way, I've just expressed the entire course. So we got, yeah, that's the end. So
you stress about the induction and deduction. Induction and deduction, the human person. The human person, exist people que induction y other person deduction. The general, a particular thing, the particular, a general.
Yes.
Knowledge.
Yes. But if you read to the end of Boltov's chapter, he talks about particularity and generality. And we're back into the left and right brain forms of understanding. So induction and deduction are things that we do when we've already split things up and isolated things. So we deduce and we make, you know, we generalize from bits to form a unity, and then on the basis of the unity we can make deductions about the bits. But it all relies on us having split everything up. It's whereas here we're going behind induction and deduction into a place where we haven't it's not that you haven't split everything up, because of course the table's there and it's distinct from everything else, but we haven't pulled the table out of its context. The table's still there in the room with all of us sitting around it. There's a sort of a way of speaking of the table where it just, I don't know how to put it, it comes up, but it doesn't lose it doesn't lose touch with everything around it. And there's another way where you think about it and you snatch the table and it becomes this thing in abstract space, which is more like how a mathematician thinks, although I don't want to be rude about mathematics. Well, let's not go into probability now. So, so I'm just going. I think, you know, we've been talking about these slides, but we'll just skip over them gently. So, the event of meaning is the appearance of meaning. For Boltov, what he's talking about what I would call coming back into now, is he calls a shifting of the attention upstream. He's got this metaphor of upstream and downstream. So upstream, if you like, everything collapses back into the immediacy of this moment, and downstream you start to separate things out and reflect and think about them. So downstream, you've just absorbed the meaning of what I've said, and now you can think about it. Yes, if you're upstream, you can't think about the meaning of what I'm saying, because as soon as you try and think about it, you've left it. Do you know, upstream, it's just all happening now. But it's quite possible, and we do it necessarily. We do abstract ourselves, and we think about the meaning of what somebody has said. And an awful lot of what we say is occurring in that space. There's a danger here, you see, especially when we've been talking about left and right brain, to insidiously, one goes, oh, right brain, it's all so holistic, do you know? But in fact, one has to remember that almost the entire class, we're using the left brain. In fact, I would say almost what we're attempting to do, another way of putting it in phenomenology, is we're attempting to inform the left brain about its own background. You don't have to inform the right brain about that, it already knows it. You don't have to give it a class. You can just sit here. You don't need to tell it anything. Do you see? So So one, I think it's clear, I should make it clear that this whole show is for the benefit of that rational side, because it's got disconnected. So how do you do it? Well, you have to keep going back, if you like, to a place where there's a unity of the immediacy of experience, and then, you know, then come back, and in a way you say, do you see? And I can always see Left Brain going, yeah, all right, John, I see, okay, whoever John is. That's a problem, of course. When you start doing this sort of stuff, you start ending up, well, who the hell am I? So the shifting upstream, understanding is not a response to a meaning, which is there already. It is the appearance of meaning. There is no meaning until there's understanding. So there are unity. But then you say, well, if there's a unity, why have we got two words? Well, because later we can separate them. I mean, the title of this chapter is Unfinished Meaning. The thing about when we think, the whole process of thinking is a fixing. So that we freeze things. Do you see the nature of now is now is now is now? I mean, even if you try and think about now, you know what the brain does. It says, oh, well, there must be an awful lot of them. There's now, and then there's now, and then there's now, and then there's now. But of course, there isn't an awful lot of nows. There's only now. Do you see? It's a continual flow. But if you think about it, you say, "Oh, I've got a now." No, it's gone. Sorry, that's not now. You see, as soon as it's not now, it's not now. There's a paradox here. Do you see where you can't make a thing out of now? Or but the left brain can only think by, I mean, almost there's a word by thingifying. You know, it you can only think by freezing.
It is nowing.
Yeah, nowing. Nowing is different.
Yeah.
Nowing is much more relaxing, isn't it? Don't you find it? Nobody can be good at nowing. Do you know? Oh, you're so good at nowing. No, you don't have to do anything. So he's saying at the bottom there, this shift of attention is inevitable, which separates meaning and understanding. Because there's something equally necessary. When we reflect in a right way, we make something known to ourselves. Do you see? It's if you are just utterly flowing along with what is now, do you see? You just be, everything would just be happening.
Yeah, it's all about being receptive,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
The probability.
Yeah.
Is the incertitude about the probability?
But if we're just present now, we're not making anything explicit. What our reflection does is it can make something explicit, and that seems to matter. Do you know? It's like in making something explicit. It brings it to consciousness, and you can, in a sense, you can realize something, and then once you've realized something, you can let it go again. But the actual realizing, like what we're talking about now, that meaning and understanding form a unity, we've used what we would call the left brain to make that explicit and to see it, bring it before consciousness, and then we can let it go again. But the actual seeing changes your understanding. Do you see? The understanding that you bring to bear, that understands what I'm saying, You had to make it. Do you know it's the accumulation of past moments where you've made things conscious. You see, you can't chop one side of your intelligence off and say, oh, the reflective side is just making a mess of the world or anything like that. Because it's only because of your ability to reflect that you've been able to make things explicit to consciousness. And that has made your understanding as well. Do you see the two are utterly dependent on each other? And if you get into it far enough, you start to see the necessity of it, and you see, oh, there's a level here where it all works together, and nothing's a problem for either side. Do you see the flowing into the background into your focused consciousness, your realization of something, and then that falling back into your understanding? There's a cycling going between where the freezing of something is okay, so long as you unfreeze it. You know, you bring it to a frozen representation and then you let it go. There's no teaching here that says thou shalt not. It's more, do you see that, how can I put this? How utterly ignorant we are as a culture of what I'm talking about here. It's just not on the agenda. The agenda is almost totally determined by the left brain saying, oh, look at this, look at this, look at this. Oh, and then look at this, look at this. And then that happened, and then that happened. Let me tell you what I did today. And what's on the news? And what are we going to do about that? Do you see it's a continuous obsession with the foreground? I'll just read this, because that way I can be sure. Because I'm sort of assuming that I'm covering these slides, but I haven't read them properly since I wrote them last week. So I better just... So the unitary event of meaning/understanding in curly brackets. He's trying to be like Heidegger here. Heidegger used to do it with hyphens. But he wants to say, they can be pulled apart, but I want you to see them together. I want you to see them as a unity. Is an encounter with meaning which is active because it is happening now. The key insight here is that the being of meaning is always now. So, because the temptation is to say the meaning of the book is somehow in the book, but the meaning of the book is only has its being in my reading it or your reading it. That's only then is the meaning present, and it's not, there's no other meaning that it is a kind of a copy of. I mean, this is phenomenology. This is phenomenology. It's almost a trick for the brain, because it's the same. There's no other Alex, right? Alex only has being, or is only here insofar as there is an appearance of Alex. And as soon as you might say, well, does that mean you're not there when I turn my head? Well, you're there for you, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, something's happening.
But does it say we project meaning back into the book then?
Well, it depends. I mean, this is jumping ahead a little bit in the lecture, but if I was to put it in my own sort of language, there's certainly a structure of words in there. You know, I can almost picture it as a three-dimensional shape, but it's because it's in language, so every word in language is connected to every other word. Do you see? You can't pick a word out and have it as isolated. It only the word cat only means cat in the context of it being of all the other mammals that you distinguish it from. Do you know a cat points to a dog, points to a mouse? Do you know the very meaning of what cat is when we go back into the senses is what distinguishes it as in being a cat, and if you look into what distinguishes it in being a cat, then all of the other things that it's distinguished from are like shading off from it. Do you know, it's like the visual field, that the rest of the room's shading off from it. If you look at a cat, it's like all the other, the word cat, all the other associated words, that you can see that it's just a distinction that we draw. Yes. So if you look at a book, it's a structure of words, but the words themselves are these multidimensional, almost effervescent things, aren't they? That are not simple at all. But there's a sense in which that structure, you don't project a meaning onto it. But of course, you have to know what the words mean. Yes, but it encounters you.
Yeah.
It's almost like I feel like it's if I'm trying to picture it, it's like anything. It's a multidimensional high level form, but it's like a robin. You know, it's like you in effect, you're allowing it to evoke something in you. But there's a sense in which you could say that. But the evoking in you, it does involve your projecting too. Yes, because you see the word and you have to project what you know the word evokes a projection in you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you're passive. It's a passive, it's almost a response. But if you don't know English and you can't, it won't work, right? So obviously you're bringing all of your past understanding to bear on the text. But the text is it's more maybe another way of treating it is to say you're like a piano, and the text is going to play a tune on you. But how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. The text is just like a certain musical score. And it's now going to play.
And not only that, it will also change you from being the piano that you were when you started.
Oh yes.
Because it's not just like a piano; it's more, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Then,
well, it's almost like it's like the piano are actually all your axons and dendrites, and they do change if you want them. If you want them, they do change as a result of playing the text on you. They actually do. They're dynamic too. So the instrument really, if you can live with the metaphor, because I don't want you to fall into thinking, oh, I'm just a bunch of physical neurons. But in a way, if we can accept it as a metaphor, it's quite a beautiful metaphor of the piano. Is the all of the neurons in the brain responding to what I'm saying right now? You know, and it's all different in everyone, right? So I may have said something to someone that they've never heard before, and you know that is going to excite a whole lot of stuff in that musical instrument, you know. Whereas if you play on a piano, you play something that the piano's never heard before. It doesn't care, right? It doesn't respond. Well, as far as we know, I guess it slightly affects the tuning of the strings, doesn't it?
It's quite interesting because with sort of violins, especially, the more you play them, the more resonant they become.
Yeah.
Because the grain in the wood compresses somewhere, so it does leave an impression.
Yes.
When you play.
Yeah. Yeah, now resonance was the word I was about to use for what's going on.
Mm. I remember reading something about Yehudi Menuhin playing the violin, and how some scientists discovered that he and the violin were one in terms of, you know, this part of his body was just resonating like the violin. Mm. So he had become one with the violin, and they were able to measure that.
Yes, they they're doing that, and at that level, they're showing how, with brain scans, how certain instruments tools, not just violins, but that the brain starts to treat the tool as like the hand. You know, it starts to extend its. You can see the neuronal projections are starting to treat the hammer or the screwdriver, especially if you're using it. You know, that's your work. It becomes something, and you know how it is. I mean, I get it with a car, right? If I go over a bump, I wince. I'm feeling the wheel. I don't exactly feel the wheel, but do you know? I mean, it depends how you feel about driving. Some part of my neural system starts to grow into the car, especially after you've had it for a number of years. You know, you really get to know every sound and everything about it. And if something happens to it, you know, it's like that rubber hand experiment. Do you remember when somebody bangs a hammer on it, you know.
My friend walked into a lamppost but it was his laptop that like touched it. He was like, ow.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh yes. The laptop, yes. Yes. Well, the laptop's a funny thing, isn't it? Because the screen takes you into another dimension. It's almost like the thing about these screens is that they're like the brain. Do you know when you look in, when I'm talking about you stay now and you stay present now and then you think about something, it takes you into another place that is now but not now. It's now but not now. And the screen of the phone and the computer is the same place, right? Externalized. It's an external mind. It's a now but not now. It's troubling, actually. It's troubling. and how, you see, it's, because I'm old enough to have watched it. I mean, it's not a great change. It used to be, everyone was walking down the street like this. And you can see, they're just looking at the, I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that, I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that. But now they're going, you know, it's the same, except it's the phone's, it was so boring up there, I guess.
Some people
don't think.
I have a friend who just doesn't think the books
on. Well, that's... I did that once many years ago in Brighton. I walked out of the flat I was staying in, and I was just... nothing happening. Do you know? Just nothing. Here I am. It's a beautiful day, utterly empty in me, and I'm walking down the street, and this guy is walking towards me, and I know he's there too. You know, it's just, it was like, and it's in moments like that where you know everyone else is like somewhere else. They're not there. And that's, you know, that's me most of the time too. But for some reason that day I wasn't there, and this guy, and we just said, oh, hi. You know, somebody else is actually here. It's quite...
Well, you had a conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, it was just so glaringly, you know, obvious. There are only two conscious people, and this is on King's Road, you know, on the seafront. I mean, there might have been someone over there we hadn't clocked. But I certainly think, you know, of a few hundred people on that day... we were the only two that were actually present. Briefly, you know. I probably immediately after that, I would have been going, that wasn't that interesting, you know, a whole stream of thoughts about the interaction. But in that moment, it was quite, it was so obvious. But that's let me write. What were we talking about?
Piano.
Oh, piano, resonance,
yeah.
The event of understanding. And you were asking about what does happen when you read a text. So we were getting somewhere with that sense of resonance and how the text resonates in you. I think it would have been a great word for Bortov to use. He doesn't actually use it, but...
the text is a doorway through which you find...
This is with a bit last week when you were talking, Nicolette, a text is a doorway through which the past can come to life for us now. Remember we were looking at that last week? And that... That amazing thing when somebody else's, somehow their reality, the reality of what they were seeing is brought before you. maybe decades later, and the person's died, and you catch how amazing it is, and what an amazing thing language is, that you can do that with language, that you can, and with writing, not just language, but the amazing thing that you can freeze it somehow and fix it in a book, and then make it live again. I mean, that's all art does that, of course. All art does that. But if you, when you catch it, I mean, I think there's a mystery behind that that we aren't even close to, which is the being of a work of art. You know, what's that?
That's a whole.
Yeah, what's that? Because it's almost you know for the artists. For the person who, if it's something like this that has this power, it's almost like it's almost like you do feel, all right, so maybe the meaning is only now, but something was in the psyche tapping that artist on the shoulder, saying, come on, I've got something to show you. You know, and you what is that? It's not. Oh well, I leave that with the dot dot dot. You know.
Well, some writers say that they say they start writing and then the characters, you know, it's like but they take over and they end up producing something that wasn't what they originally. But it wasn't that they thought it through; it just came through as they were. In the process.
Yes. Yeah. No. I mean, even writing philosophy, it can be like that. You there's a definite when the writing's happening, it's coming like the speech now.
Yeah,
where from?
Is,
where from?
His eyes and the way, like he's somewhere else, you know. So I can't do that. And, I haven't seen that before, you know. So I haven't seen a writer writing. I saw my grandfather, the look on his face when he was writing poetry. It was stunning.
Yes.
Yeah. I'd love to see that. You know,
yeah.
I'd love to be in the company of someone when they write it.
So I know I can't
write
poetry. I don't think that I can reach there.
You could try. You can connect to yourself and to the divine.
But I think it's much better.
Yeah, we all have it in us. So if you don't try and be him, but just be you, because you can't see what you look like from the outside. So if you really got into it, you wouldn't be aware that you were.
But also, when you read it,
him.
you see the technique.
I'm sure he's brilliant, but if you wanted to. And you make beautiful things that were your beautiful things, not your beautiful things.
I'm into poetry.
Well, there you go.
So I'm going to say we've got that more or less nailed, because maybe the hermeneutic reversal. There was a big section in the reading about Aristotle that I missed out because I've already got too many slides. But there's a little reference back to that where, one of the things that he was saying from Aristotle was that the idea that if you're teaching, then the place that the teaching is happening is in each one of you. That's where the reference to Aristotle was, because he wants to say that in a similar way, the meaning of the text, the sight of the meaning of the text, is in each one of us, not in the author, not in the book. It's occurring here. It's occurring in this. I mean, I point there, but I don't know where to point.
It's more like a mirror. A book is a mirror. You don't get something new. It just rearranges your own concepts.
Yes.
You kind of read your own concept and your own understanding of what things are.
But the work has no being without you and you and you, it does. It has no being. That's where it becomes what it is, only insofar as some human consciousness somewhere is able to provide a kind of a ground for it to appear. So that, in Aristotle's language, a text has the potential to mean and a reader has the potential to understand. There is a single actualization of both. I feel the sad thing is about human progress. You know, I was saying about the scientific revolution wiping away the medieval world, and we mutter about, you know, burning witches, and we've got a kind of a picture of the medieval world. But in fact, it was suffused with Aristotelian understandings that in many ways we're now in holistic science returning to. Do you know what goes around comes around? It's like human progress always seems to be like this. You basically take a certain way of life which had something not so good in it and something very profound in it, and you just throw the lot away. You throw the good and the bad. It never seems that we say, we'll keep what was profound about Aristotle. You know, we won't just say it's all rubbish, let's start again. Because certainly you never really do start again. You just pick up something else that the Greeks thought of. Yes. But it's interesting in this. You see, he's reintroducing Aristotle here because Aristotle's understanding of being was more profound than Descartes. I think you could put it simply as that. You know, the Descartes' understanding of being was, ba-boom, here's the physical stuff. It's dead, it's inert, it's just corpuscles extended in space. I mean, they became atoms, but essentially, that's it. Extended in space, matter, stuff. And over here, consciousness or mind, and that's what is. And the extended stuff is just ruled by the laws of physics, if you like. It's got no intelligence in itself. Whereas Aristotle still had a sense that there was intelligence in the matter. And I think we're having to come back to thinking, well, maybe there's some intelligence in the matter.
So he's indicating that maybe some intelligence in the matter in the text has potential to mean. So there's a potentiality in things to...
I was actually thinking more deeply about Aristotle's notion of the soul is the form of the body. We talked about, I think we did, about autopoiesis, about the form of the living cell, that the matter is just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, and the being of the cell is its form. The form that the matter is in its movement, it's tracing out an enduring form. And so long as that enduring form is being traced out, then the cell is alive. That's quite an Aristotelian notion of form and matter. And the whole human body, similarly, is a form that is not the matter. But the movement of the matter is tracing out the form. And it's an interesting form because, in a way, there's a certain sense in which the form that I was as a child and the form that I am now is still, in some sense, the one form. So it's not... It changes over time quite dramatically. But it certainly lives and dies, so there's a notion that form is not it's not separate from the matter. You know, the matter has to be there for the form to be there. but the form has its own being. So that's just an aside to say, when we threw Aristotle out, we threw out a whole lot of stuff that now we're saying, oh God, we've ruined the earth. We've ruined the earth because we thought it was just a bunch of dead bits of sand.
Wholeness of the work of art. The work of art is a whole.
Yes. Yes. Yes, this understanding of wholeness and understanding of parts is like a pendulum, and we swung to an understanding of the parts and left behind an understanding of the whole. But again, you know, it's like it all seems to be expressed in this dualism of how the brain works as well. It's all interestingly connected. But keep going, John. There is a single actualization of both the potential to mean in the text and the potential to understand in the reader, because the actualizing of meaning is the actualizing of understanding. As in the case of the teacher and the student, we can see that here the actualizing of meaning, the meaning, meaning that meaning isn't a thing, it's a verb, occurs in the reader. But this certainly does not make it just subjective, since it is the meaning itself which actualizes in the reader. We could say that the meaning participates the reader. So in a way we're talking about the resonating of the meaning in our own consciousness here. If we participate in the meaning, it is because primarily the meaning participates us. And this is understanding. In the hermeneutic reversal, the meaning becomes us. We could put it the other way round and say that we are becomed by the meaning. And in this sense, we become a subject for the meaning. Now, I wonder if you sense we just talked about that together when we were talking about how meaning interacts, how there's a structure here in the book. There is something that's coming that you could say the book has a meaning, but it doesn't come into being until it's in us, which makes it look subjective, but it isn't. It's the effect of that form on us. I think we were talking about it, and it changes us. If we get to the end of the lecture, and we're going to, he's going to say, and we change the meaning. The meaning of the work also changes.
Which is interesting in teaching. I would imagine, not that I teach in that way, but teaching the meaning of books and the meaning of literature.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm thinking of Dickens. What Dickens means now.
And what, you know, like when you're doing your A levels or whatever, you get told what the meaning is, don't you, when you're at school or college or
the experience
or university, and they kind of tell you, you know, you've got all these books to guide you in what the meaning of J. Florence's Sons and Lovers are or something like that, anything, you know, or the high literature.
Oh, and, Federico, but you are here.
And then that sort of could ruin it for you.
Yes.
Because, you know, you're in, I don't know what it's like now at school, because I'm not.
It's more so now.
Is it more so? I would have thought maybe in some schools maybe it's not. It's changed a bit.
They haven't been reading their Heidegger then.
Oh, no. So you go around with this meaning, you know, it says this, that, and the other, and you're going to do your exam in A-level English or whatever, and in literature, and you've got to write it in that way, whereas it takes away the meaning of how you might see it.
School does that with all subjects, doesn't it? Because you have to get tested on it, so it's a different thing from learning something.
Yeah,
so you're curious.
And there's something else that was occurring to me, bringing the teacher up in mind, is that when I think back to the teachers I remember,
mm.
and you know, you hear people talk about a particular teacher having
yeah.
an influence, there's something about them enabling you to discover
that's
this
right.
for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so there's something, so why that
Which
came to mind
teacher,
was I was thinking. I was reflecting there, John. I shouldn't have been.
No, no, reflection. We've got to do both. Yeah.
I was thinking, so what is it about certain teachers
yeah.
where they make
yeah.
that change?
Yeah.
Not to do with the content.
No.
They change you. They change your being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I
what
think
is
they're
it
real,
about
they're,
that?
They have that quality.
And it has to do with
yeah.
you, them, and I don't know what.
Yeah. And their appreciation of you, I
yeah.
think, as well.
But there's a lot going on
yeah.
that comes from the teacher
That's
that
right.
is not necessarily concept.
Oh, yeah.
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 And their love of teaching, maybe, as well.
The love of the subject as well, you know, the passion with the subject.
Yeah.
So it's not just words is what I'm trying to say.
And interestingly, for me, it was a maths teacher, which isn't a subject you'd associate with it, but...
yeah.
Mr. Knight, he was. You know, you always remember the name as well, don't you?
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
The way he taught was a bit like this. He would just be explaining what he's doing on the board, and I would be understanding.
Mm.
You know, no big deal. Whereas in many classes, it ain't like that.
Mm.
Somebody's sort of just da 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 da, and it's not going in, or you're not even listening. But somehow or other, his communication to me was, all he needed to do was go through it on the board, and at the end of the day, I understood it,
yeah.
and you know, and it's like an invisible thing, you don't go at the end of the day, oh, what an amazing teacher, although on reflection, I see that he was, and he wasn't talking about literature, he wasn't talking about refined ideas, he was talking about quadratic equations, you know, but in it went. You know.
My son's favourite A-level teacher at the minute is his further maths teacher, and she loves maths so much, she just does it for fun. Like on a lunch break or when we went to parents' evening, in between parents, she's doing maths problems for fun. It's like magic to her, and she loves it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was able to do... I think I modelled myself on Mr. Knight when I taught computing. Because... I thought that's the way it's got to be. You've got to get in a stream of communication where nobody even notices that you're teaching.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you, and you have to be in a state like this where it's just coming out of you, as well. You know, there has to be no gap of what is it? You know, as soon as there's a gap, it all starts to fall apart, or can easily fall apart, especially with that kind of teaching, because there are times I look back at the code on the screen and I just have no idea, you know, because I was, you know, you're in the flow without reflecting, and then suddenly you lose it. Anyway, nobody minds. Yeah.
You know that level of understanding then with literary criticism, that's further downstream, isn't it? It's not about we're talking about here.
You what? Understanding mathematics.
And literature, like that, the sort of putting things in a context and getting that level of meaning, because you know, there's meaning, and then it's what it really means. You know, you've got that sort of that pattern of language, where I thought this was just there's a level of meaning which is really immediate.
Yes.
I understand, you know, in its pure sort of linguistic sense, without being able to contextualise it. Is that what we're talking about?
I thought we were talking about literature. Maybe I'm going, maybe I'm
going. So I would, there's a level where every, there aren't two levels of meaning. It's all meaning. So I'm not sure what the distinction is that you want to draw here.
The immediate meaning of a word.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what Anthony's saying. Like, the immediate meaning to you from, like, say it said cathedral on the page.
Yeah.
And you're interaction with cathedral, your kind of like understanding of what cathedral means, rather than the whole context of the literature, you know.
You can alter your frame of what you're looking at.
So I took it to mean that it meant, you know, I pick up a book and I read, and it comes out at me, the whole flowing of the meaning.
Yes.
Of that book. Whether it be, but there are different modes of being, aren't there, in that, because if you're not really enjoying the book, then it still happens, I suppose, but in a different.
Yes, but there's a level
as
here.
You're saying about the actual meaning of the word.
So you've got
more object.
The chicken crossed the road.
Yeah.
But why did the chicken cross the road? That's it. Do you mean?
No.
You got chicken crossed the road is literal.
Yes.
The chicken crossed the road. You get on board with that. But when you think about that in with the cultural reference of that being set up for a joke. There's a mystery as to why the chicken crossed the road, and I'm wondering why, what does this actually mean? But even though I know the meaning of this actual bit of language is the chicken crossed the road.
But you're drawing a distinction here where you're saying that there's something like a literal meaning?
Yeah.
And I don't know that there ever is a literal meaning.
Right.
It's almost like you're reminding me almost of perception, of thinking that at the bottom of perception there's actually sensations like colour and sound, but that everything that you perceive has a meaning, and I don't know that there's ever a ground meaning to language. Everything is within a context.
You can't
take anything without a context. Even if the context is, I'm taking this out of context.
Yeah, right.
That's still a context.
Mm.
It's always in context, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, something that Nicolette was saying there about having a meaning imposed on a text.
Well, that is classic teaching, isn't it?
Yes. There's great complexity of meaning there, isn't there? You were reminding me that, unfortunately, if Maria, you're here again, listening, you've just reminded me again, of course, about why I insist, and used to, that you don't read the book on Heidegger, you read Heidegger. Because it's like you were saying, Nicolette, once you've read the book on Heidegger, you've got somebody else's idea of the meaning of Heidegger, that's already going to distort the effect that Heidegger is going to have on you when you read him.
Mm.
You know, you're already set up with a certain frame. Philosophy like that is like literature. You know, you actually want to be as open as you can be to see what it does to you. But there is a different level where you're suspicious of a meaning. Do you know when you're not? There's a whole dimension here about the way language works, which we might be able to go into. I think we will. Which it has a double. It has two faces. It can be revealing, or it can be concealing. So that all of the ground of propaganda and deception, of course, lies in language as well. And if there's an intent to deceive in the language that you're hearing, then you can't. It's like that's definitely a different kind of meaning. It's an intent to cover over. I mean, this is again, if I was Greek, I could maybe pronounce aletheia. Aletheia?
Aletheia.
Aletheia will do, yes. The original Greek word that came down to mean truth, but was more about that truth was an unconcealing. That the whole work of language isn't just a pure revealing of meaning. It can do both. Because when you speak of something, it's like you're opening something. But you've got the power to say that you're opening something, and yet what you're opening is really a covering over of the actual thing that you purport to be speaking of. So there's this double. You know, it's like in our very listening, you have to have a. I think we all have this, don't you? There's a kind of a little weather vane here or something that says, what's the intention here? But it's so subtle. It's not just the intention. It's you have to read the being of the one who's speaking, don't you? Because somebody can be speaking with, as far as they're concerned, no intent to deceive, but of course, if your entire view of the world is utterly distorted, you can't but help to give it to everyone else.
Are they deceiving by doing it for the greater of the country or something? You know, then they get acquitted. Because it's not a lie if you lie for.
I know, that's just
for a greater cause.
What's that like? Impeachment?
Yeah.
It's just incredible that can happen in broad daylight and. That's fine.
Have you read? We had to read it at school. George Orwell's 1984.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of a set text, and he introduced the idea of double speak there. And we're in that world.
Yeah.
We might not be in that communist dictatorship, but in our public life, it's double speak.
Double speak.
Double speak. So everything means what it doesn't mean. Nothing, if you like, the whole reference of language has gone wrong, and it's deliberately gone wrong.
So you're the Ministry of Love, which is the Ministry of War.
Yes, yes. Well, we already have that, don't we? You know,
Turkey called its aggression Kurdish areas.
Yeah.
What olive branch?
Yeah. No, it's double speak. If you want a word for double speak is, it's called public relations.
Yeah.
It means that it no longer matters what's happened. What matters is how it appears it's how it's described. It's the effect that the description has on the hearer. That's public relations, right? We have to create a certain impression without saying anything that's demonstrably false. It's the utter debasement of language, and it's become. The language with which the universities present themselves to prospective students, to which I can almost start to cry.
Mm, it's horrible. High schools as well.
What is that?
Even
the entire public relations industry has taken over how the university system presents itself, and the people at the university, of which I wish some were listening, who are supposed to be the defenders of truth, didn't even notice somehow. I mean, a few of us noticed, but in terms of what should have happened, which is, okay, well, it's all over. We're not teaching here anymore.
My son signed up for Sussex in September.
Well, no, let me say that what's happened is that is that everyone sort of said, oh, well, in my little pocket, once you get in my classroom, then I'll start being truthful with you. But do you see, once the organisation is infected...
Do you know anything about the zoology department there?
It's fabulous. Departments like zoology and anything to do with biology, it all comes down to whether there's any, whether the background understanding is utterly mechanistic. Because that can have a very depleting effect at a certain level on, as you become deeply introduced to the idea that everything that occurs in animal bodies is a kind of a mechanistic cause and effect, result of a series of accidents that we call evolution. If you absorb that far enough, the meaningfulness of life. I remember reading quite deeply into this and experiencing it sitting on my veranda, like really entering into that world and just seeing it. It's the frame of understanding from which it comes, and it's extraordinarily bleak. But generally not for the people who are saying, and now we're going to do this experiment, you know, and we're going to discover this, and we're going to discover that, and we're very fascinated with our research. But in the background, you have to look very carefully into what do people think it means to be alive? What does it mean to be conscious? What does it mean to do biology if you can't answer those questions? I mean, I'm about to get upset.
The Ministry of Peace was the one.
The Ministry of Peace. Well, we already have it, don't we? The Ministry of Defence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Ministry of Defence.
So, you know, when was the last time that the UK was invaded? In 1066, if you want to know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They've obviously done a very good job. Anyway,
Well, they tried to invade in 1939.
Yeah.
When?
39.
Oh, yeah, no, we've had Hitler. There was a bit of defence going on. I'm not saying there wasn't a bit of defence going on here and there. But
you know, Britain stopped the war. No, really, Greece stopped.
Don't start me. I feel like, you know the Monty Python? No, we didn't. You invaded Poland. No, not picking on you, but, you know. I think the invasion of Poland was, you know...
But the Soviet Union invaded Poland too. Why Britain didn't invade the Soviet Union?
Resist
and desist. So we're becomed by the meaning. And the second paragraph is about... But the more sort of traditional understanding is that... when we do it from a subject-centered perspective, we consider that we've grasped the meaning. You know, that it's something out there and we have actively grabbed it. Like we've bought something off the shelf of the supermarket. You know, that we've actively... It's like a commodity almost that we've grasped. And then we've got ideas of appropriation and assimilation. That we take the meaning that something's given us and we assimilate it, which means we kind of fit it in to the way that we already understand things. I don't know if you know how that goes. Sometimes I catch it in myself and I catch it in the way other people comment. It's like you don't really. I remember it. When I was giving talks at university, trying to put some of this material over, and I would I'd get the questions back, and quite often I realised actually all that's happening here is what I would call pigeonholing. They've heard what I've had to say, And they think, okay, so what's his position? It sounds like an idealist. Maybe he's a transcendental idealist. I wonder. I'd be getting questions, not really, they didn't want to know the answer. They just wanted to know, does he belong in this box or in that box? Do you know? I've taken what you've said, and all I'm really doing is I'm classifying it within what I already know. Do you know? And in a way, I could tell that with these, that you can't say that nothing got in. You never know, because right brain's always listening. But as far as the one who is asking the questions, you could see that nothing that I had said had penetrated. But it was still had been understood in a way. Do you know, as in the words had been taken aboard, and basically we go, yeah, no, I agree with that, that's wrong, and that's wrong. But he's a thingo, you know. And finally, philosophers don't finally disagree unless you've made a mistake. They just say, oh, so you believe that. Good. So I know what you believe. Next. You know, it's like a way of dealing with meaning where you don't really allow it to manifest in you. I think you might know what I mean. There will be things that I'll read where I'm like that, because I do fundamentally disagree with what's being said, and I wouldn't allow it into me. I can't. You know, there are things which you can't let in just because they don't correspond. So we'll have lunch now, I think. Yes, because relativism is a sort of another issue, because it's got its grip, I think, in our culture. So it's worth spending a bit of time on it.